Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is Episode 8, This is a Calling. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. I'm humbled by our topic for this episode, where we will be talking about teaching, the importance of good role models, and how critical it is for caring adults to be there for our kids. I'm especially excited because our guest is someone many of you know. You've probably seen his face on TV. You may have caught him on Broadway. And today you'll get to listen to his oh-so-familiar voice as he shares his stories with you. Tony Danza is here to take us from a boxing ring in Brooklyn to his big break on the TV show Taxi, to a stint as a rookie English teacher at Northeast High in Philly. You don't want to miss this, my friends. You might even get to hear Mr. Danza sing a song or two. But first, we have our intro segment, which features freedom writer Tanisha Knight. Tanisha talks about her family's humble beginnings, her collegiate basketball career, and how education inspired her to teach one to teach another. Next, we'll have our diary of the day, an excerpt from Tony's book, aptly titled, I'd Like to Apologize to Every Teacher I've Ever Had. Then finally, our featured discussion is with Tony Danza himself. Tony gives us a glimpse into what it was like growing up in Brooklyn, becoming a boxer, and cultivating a career in entertainment. Then, Tony takes us to that moment that he chose a different stage and became a high school English teacher. As you listen, you will laugh, you will learn, and you might even swoon a little. All the while, I invite you to ponder, what is your calling? And how can you find and follow it? Thank you for tuning in to our show. Now here's Tanisha.
I am Tanisha Knight, an educated Black woman, an anthropology lover, a basketball player, and I am a freedom writer. My grandmother's side of the family comes from Fort Worth, Texas. She was a farmer. She lived on a plantation where they shared crops. And my grandfather was of Native American descent, and they were really hard workers too. They had 14 children. My grandmother instilled that in my aunts and my mother, the ability to hustle. But my mother was illiterate until she was 30. And she went back to school. She's the only one out of 14 children that actually went back to school to learn and to study. So she's my hero. She came from nothing. You know, we grew up really poor, and now she owns her own property, and she owns two cars, and she's really independent. So I wanted to become like her. When I graduated Wilson, I was in varsity basketball. I was one of the top scorers. I actually received a full scholarship at San Diego State. Erin was the first person to hop on and say, if you need me to help you with anything, let us know. And having an awesome mentor like Erin really kept my spirits up. I ended up studying social science to help me understand where I come from and who I am as a woman. And then I received my second degree in anthropology. It ended up being a really, really awesome experience. Right now, I'm pursuing my teaching credential in physical education, and after that, I will be receiving my master's in education. Ultimately, I would love to get the experience in education so that I can become a professor. My nephew just went to college. He's the second person to go to college in our family. Really proud of him, and got his own scholarship just as I did, and I'm learning that education is key and that it'll take me somewhere in life so that I can provide for myself and I'm able to give back to my community and give back to my family and helping them understand what's going on in the world today.
I'm so inspired by how she's evolved and how she uses her education to give back and make a difference. Tanisha is one of the dedicated freedom writers who train educators at our teacher institutes. We fly in educators from all over the globe. While they arrive as strangers, they leave as a family, inspired and equipped to more effectively and empathetically serve their students. Tony Danza was so moved by our teacher training program that he personally sponsored a colleague from Northeast High to attend. Now, Joe Connolly is a Freedom Rider teacher and a special part of our beloved brethren. If you know a teacher that would be an ideal candidate to become a Freedom Rider teacher, please reach out to us. You can either click on the link in the show notes or email us at fwi@freedomridersfoundation.org. Now it's time for our diary of the day. This excerpt comes from Tony Danza's New York Times best-selling book, I'd Like to Apologize to Every Teacher I've Ever Had. It takes us back to a moment in Tony's classroom when two of his students brought in a DVD and begged him to play a movie called Freedom Riders. Here are Tony's words about that experience and his reaction to the film, read by Freedom Rider Latia Kane.
The rest of the week, only a handful of kids come to class. The air conditioning is on strike again, and I pretty much resigned to just shooting the breeze with the kids. Two of my girls, Paige and Tiana, show up with a DVD and ask if we could watch a movie. They've been nagging me to watch this film all year. What I know about Freedom Riders is that it chronicles the true story of a young teacher, played by Hilary Swank, who goes to an inner city school and tries to make a difference. It's a by-the-numbers tale of rough kids and a caring teacher who refuses to give up on them. I don't want to see some sappy movie, I say over and over. No, Mr. Danza, Paige insists. It's real good. You'll like it. Finally, they wear me down. Okay, put it on. They jump up, put it in the computer, turn on the projector, and then take seats directly in front of me. For the next 2 hours, I sit at my desk and sob as the movie plays and Paige and Tiana watch me as if I'm the show. They love that it gets to me. Afterwards, they hand me a Kleenex and pat me on the back. I seem to have passed some kind of challenge. That movie was their final test for me. If the story touched me as it did them, that would mean I really do care.
It's amazing to me how everyone's lives are intertwined in some way. When I first picked up Tony's book, I didn't know what to expect. But as I turned each page, I felt a deeper and deeper connection to his words and how beautifully he captures our collective experience as teachers. Tony does an extraordinary job of portraying those indelible moments, both in his book and in our conversation for this podcast. So it's time for our featured discussion. I promise I won't keep him from you any longer. Recorded at the office of Penguin Random House in the heart of New York City, I give you my conversation with actor, writer, and teacher extraordinaire, Tony Danza. I want to welcome one of the most talented individuals I know. He is a boxer, an actor, a writer, and the reason I was so intrigued by having our guest be a part of our show is what he chooses to do, paying it forward for the underdog. So someone who was at the top of their career, our guest Tony Danza decides that he wants to go back and be a classroom English teacher. And so I want to take you on this odyssey today of what would make somebody at the height of their professional career suddenly say, I want to give back to kids. Welcome to our show, Tony.
Thank you, Erin. So nice to be here with you, and what a wonderful introduction. I'm blushing.
So, Tony, can you tell our listeners about your childhood? You were a New York kid, mm-hmm. and you have really humble roots. I love how you talk so lovingly about your dad, who was a sanitation worker. Can you tell me about your father and how your relationship with him influenced you?
Yeah, he's the garbage man for the city. And we grew up in East New York in Brooklyn, under the L on Pitkin Avenue and Bobby Street. And he worked on the street I lived on and went to school on. And so I was always so proud of him because he used to drop me off at school with the truck. But he was, son of immigrants. My mother was first generation. They got here in 29, just in time for the Depression. So they struggled with poverty and just trying to find a new way in a new country, you know, language. And I don't have to tell you that at the time, America was just as unwelcoming to immigrants of that ilk as they are to some today. So they struggled with all of that. But, you know, he fought in the war. He was a Bronze Star Medal winner. He fought in three major battles. He was with the Fifth Army going up through Italy, Arno, Rome, Po Valley. He never said a word about it, how I would love to sit down and ask him about it. But I lost him when, you know, I was only in my early 30s, so I really didn't get a chance. He was one of those guys, you know. He wasn't a lovey-dovey guy. He was really tough and strict, and I'll give you a reason to cry. But, you know, he was, you knew he cared about you, and you knew he was there. And it's one of the things I speak about now, you know. One of the things I think that about kids today is that it's so much harder for them because they don't know what they're supposed to do. See, one of the things that we don't do as adults is we don't accept the responsibility that what we saw as kids had a tremendous effect on us. So many good role models, you know, your TV, the school, you're in the street, the guy that crossed you, and I never forget Sam's Market on the corner of Euclid and Ridgewood, and he crossed all the kids every day. The old man was in, you know, he'd come out of the store to cross you to go to. And so there was that kind of thing. So many good role models provided to and for us. You can remember at the time there was a family hour on TV. So from 8 to 9, it was only so much you could do, you know, because I was on TV at that time. And I think even back to my show, Who's the Boss went off the air in 1992. I wasn't proselytizing. I really wasn't trying to preach to anybody, but I certainly, certainly was aware of the message I was sending every week. And I worked on it, and I made sure that I understood that with great influence comes some responsibility. So I don't want to seem like just an old man, an old fart, an old Luddite. But, you know, I don't think that happens anymore. And so now kids, instead of having to look for a bad role model, they have to search for a good one.
Well, let's go backwards to go forward. For my listeners, I want to go back to those small Catholic high school rooms when you had some of your spirit squashed. You had teachers that didn't see this side of you that was so charismatic and the performer. You went through school not knowing that you were going to someday be an actor. You went away to school in Iowa. So what makes a boy from Brooklyn go to Iowa to go to college?
I did go to Catholic school for a little while to sixth grade, and I got thrown out.
And another story for another episode.
That's for another day, yes. And then I was in public schools for the rest of my time. But I do a line in my show that I don't know where it came from, but just sort of struck me. That you have to be interested before you're interesting. You can't be interesting until you're interested. And I wasn't interested in school and in just about anything. And so I don't want to blame the nuns. It was mostly my fault. And as far as going to Iowa, you know, I really wanted to get away from home. I lived in New York for all my life, and I wanted to get away. I wanted to see something. I also got they accepted me, and I also got a little bit of a scholarship to go and wrestle there. But unfortunately, school wasn't it's one of the reasons I'm so interested in it now. And school wasn't a priority. I really wish I could go back and get A's. I wonder why. What was I thinking? I sometimes tell kids, you know, you can be a good student and have a good time. It's not mutually exclusive, you know. But sometimes, you know, when you were in school, it was like, you're either a partier or you're a good student, you know. And so I chose the darker side. But I'm just saying, I got through, and I always was able to get through. But I don't think I know for sure I didn't take all the advantage of it. And that eats at me, by the way.
I think you made up for last time, though.
I know, I tried. I really have. And now it's all I want to do is study.
I want to fill in a little bit of the gaps for our listeners. We have every age. What I love is for educators who've grown up watching you on television, seeing your movies, tuning in the afternoon to your talk show. You are iconic. There's roles of you going from being a boxer in the ring to being a boxer on Taxi. I mean, that's such an iconic role.
It's and the 40th anniversary of Taxi this year, too,
amazing.
By the way. Isn't that
absolutely
crazy?
Amazing.
Yeah, that's insane.
So before you were an actor, you were a boxer.
Yeah.
did the role on Taxi, was it inspired by you personally? Or how did that happen? I think it's an interesting story.
It's a stupid story, though. It's a stupid story. I was training in a gym in New York called Gleason's on 30th and 8th Avenue. It was the mecca of boxing. It was the place to be. You know, I was a club fighter. I fought all over the city. I had 15 fights. And I was seen by this guy. I thought he was up to something, but he asked me if I would read a script. I read the script. He got me a screen test, and I ended up getting this pilot The pilot didn't go anywhere. It's called Fast Lane Blues. I played Dom, a guy who loved his car more than his girlfriend. Anyway, the pilot didn't go anywhere. And I went back to New York, back to fighting. I was fighting on a Friday night, and I had done the pilot. You know, it's the same guy. This guy said, I have some guys interested in this pilot I'm writing, and you would be perfect. I said, come see the fight. What do you want for me? I'm fighting in, I was fighting in at the Nanuet Star Theater in Nyack. Long story short, I get knocked down twice in the first 30 seconds in front of the TV guys. I was down for a long time. I beat the count. The second time, I just beat the count. And in the same round, I came back and beat the guy, knocked the guy out.
It's like a metaphor for your life.
Well, a little
I
bit.
Think it's a metaphor
little bit.
For your life.
Oh, yeah, you know what it is? Lucky. That's what the metaphor is, luck. So I... The guy got crazy. He got me the screen test. I get this part. It doesn't go anywhere. But ABC had me on a pilot deal. And what happened was I ended up going up for a movie and getting the movie. I got a movie, The Warrior. So I went up for that movie. After I read, I unfurled my fight poster. It was my first main event. Had my picture on it. It said, Tough Tony Danza, Brooklyn's knockout artist. And so I unfurled it. I said, hey, you guys want to see a warrior? Come see me fight. So they did. And I knocked the guy out, and they gave me the part. I said, who is this kid? Send him to see Jim Brooks. He's casting Taxi. Jim was casting, he was looking for an Irish heavyweight, a guy named Phil Ryan. In fact, when I went up to read, there was a room full of blonde 200-pound actors. And they all looked at me like, what are you doing here? You're in the wrong place, you know? And they went, yeah, you Tony Danza, come on in. I was like, how about that? I walked in, all the other guys were like, who's this guy, you know? Anyway, so I ended up reading with Mandy Patinkin, who was reading for Judd Hirsch's part. And I got it. And I was so naive. I just want you to know how naive I was. How silly, uninterested. Remember I told you I was not interested? Jim Brooks said to me, the great Jim Brooks said to me, as I was walking out with him, he's sort of frenetic and really, you know, like a cheerleader guy. He said to me, I loved your work. And I had to pretend what I knew. I had no idea what he was talking about. What work? Did I sweep? Did I pick something up? He was talking about my acting. But what work? That wasn't work to me. And so somehow I end up in the show. They turn it from an Irish heavyweight to an Italian middleweight. Then instead of Phil Banta, they make it Tony Banta, which may have been a reflection on my acting ability because they were afraid I wouldn't answer to Phil. But in any case, that's how I ended up on the show.
So for our young students who may not know the great Jim Brooks, throw that out.
The Simpsons, number one, The Simpsons, but Terms of Endearment, As Good as It Gets, Broadcast News, Mary Tyler Moore Show. I mean, it goes on
Iconic.
And on and on. I mean, it's just he's. I mean, he's one of the, I think, one of the great geniuses I've ever been around.
So, for my listeners, Tony is an amazing performer on stage. I was blessed to see him in Honeymoon in Vegas, right here in New York on Broadway, and he can sing and tap dance and lights up a room. Is there a favorite song you like to sing? If someone put you on the spot to sing a line or two?
You know, I got my ukulele.
Can you indulge our audience?
Sure, I would love to do something. Yeah, I've been working on a little song here. This is. Yeah, let's see. All right, so I was fooling around with this. This is kind of a fun one. Another bride, another June, another sunny afternoon, another reason, another season for making whoopee. You know, you could do that.
Oh my gosh.
But I like to do like ballads. You know, what kind of ballads? Like, I've grown accustomed to her face. She almost makes the day begin. I've grown accustomed to the tune. She whispers night and noon. Her smiles, her frowns, her ups or downs are second nature to me now. Like breathing out and breathing in. I was serenely independent, content before we met. Surely I could always be that way again, and yet I've grown accustomed to her looks, accustomed to her voice, accustomed to her face.
Oh, everyone is swooning.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's, and by the way, romantically, this thing's a ray gun. Forget it. I just want to say anything.
So to go from these iconic roles like Taxi and Who's the Boss and Angels in the Outfield, suddenly you decide, I want to be a teacher. What kind of sell is that to your family, to your agent, to your friends? Because you're leaving the coast. You were in California
at
the time.
Yeah, I went to Philly, yeah.
You're going to move to Philly. Like, how does this happen?
The reason I did it, I was turning 60. And I was really having trouble turning 60. And I was at a point in my life where I was really, one of the things that happens, you know, each decade, 40, you just go crazy because you're not young anymore, but you're not old, and it's really messed up. Watch out for 40. It's really scary. 50, you start waking up with injuries. You know, you wake up, you go to bed, you find, you wake up, you got a broken leg. You wonder, how did this happen? That's 50. Then 60, all you can think about is this self-reflection. You know you're getting closer to the end of this ride, and you have to, what did you do? What didn't you do? What should you have done? What did you want to do that you didn't do? And that's what all came to me about that. And so one of the regrets I had was that I had gone to school to be a teacher, and then I'd never done it. And I was totally consumed with wanting to know what was going on in public education. And so I wanted to see. That year teaching was a real eye-opener in so many ways. What I learned was how tough it is to be a teacher.
I want you to paint a picture for our listeners. What is the difference of standing on a stage on Broadway? You know, the lights are going to come on, you're going to dance. Mm-hmm. Or doing your lines for television. Uh-huh. Or standing in front of a chalkboard with a bunch of 14-year-olds. What is more terrifying?
Well, you know what's funny is I'll never forget that first day, that first class. It was a 10th grade class. I had 30 students. I wrote my name on the wall.
Do you have good penmanship?
Oh, yeah. Well, I went to Catholic school for 6 years, so I stay in the lines, babe. So I put my name as the dancer. I turned around. And a kid raised her hand, this girl Paige, and she said, "You use deodorant?" And I was like, taken aback. And I said, what do you mean? She says, "Look at you, you're sweating like crazy." I was drenched, and it's called flop sweat. And it is the same exact feeling you get when you're on stage and you forgot your lines, or you know it's going nowhere, that joke didn't work, or, you know, it's not going well. But the problem is, or the differences, I mean, is that on stage, it's a performance. In TV, it's a cut, do it again, or cut, didn't go so well. But in a 10th grade English class, this is those kids' one chance to take 10th grade English. And so that responsibility to their future becomes such a weight, such a heavy weight, that it's easy to, you feel real, you flop sweat happens quick. You know, one of the things that I did was I cried so much that year. The emotional grind, forget about the physical and the mental grind, the emotional grind of having 150 students that you care about and that need you to care about. In some cases, you're a mother, a father, you're not only a teacher, you're everything, that you get best friend, a social worker, anything, you know. I mean, when you see that kind of need, that relationship between the kids and you, the teacher, you have a relationship with them that is so, it's so complex at times and different in each different case, and there's so many of them. In order to get the kids to work, sometimes you have to show them how much you care about them. You make them work a little bit by showing how much you care, but then they say, "Oh, he cares about me. Let me tell him about my life."
And then it breaks your heart.
And then you're dead. And sometimes you actually have to report some of the things that they tell you, you know. So that emotional grind is always so tough.
That's what struck me is I was sent your book by your editor. The title, I think, is very apropos. It's, "I would like to apologize to every teacher I've ever had." And I had a stereotype before I read it that you're the tough guy, you're Tony Danza. And I didn't expect
I like
it to be
that.
Vulnerable. I didn't expect you to be so self-deprecating. I didn't expect you to be so tender, and I found myself falling in love with your words because it was so earnest And it was such a love letter to the profession in a way that I didn't expect. That's why I pass it out to everybody, because I just want people to be proud of this field. And you gave the dignity that teachers so richly deserve.
Thank you, Erin.
Tell our listeners, I love that there was that young woman who challenged you about this certain film that was kind of schmaltzy and you had no desire to watch it.
Yeah. I had these two kids in my class, and Tatiana and Paige, and they would drive me crazy to see this movie. You gotta see this movie, God. This movie, Freedom Runners, you gotta see this movie. I'm like, I don't wanna see no schmaltzy movie. I don't want to see it. So the whole year went by, and then the last couple of days, it's like, you know, who comes to school those last few days? I don't even want to go there. But anyway, so I was sitting there, and you have to sit there, and how many kids you have come, and a lot of kids used to come and sit in my classroom because I was a schmo, and they said, Mr. Dancer, come on, let's watch the movie today. I said, all right, fine, let's watch this movie. So we set up the projector. So here's my desk is in the front. The projector is to my right. And I'm looking over my shoulder at the screen to watch it. The two kids are sitting in the first row. So they have a real good vantage point on me. And I'm watching this movie. And of course, I'm known at Northeast High as a crybaby. And this movie did me no good. On that front, boy, I was crying, and they were just loving it, watching me cry. They sat there and just watched me sob.
So instead of watching the movie, they watched you.
They just watched me sob. And it was a wonderful movie. I mean, obviously, it's so touching and so real. And, you know, and plus, I don't know, you know, I love working with kids. I just love it. I just think that they have it so much harder than we did. I think about the kid that lives at 127 Euclid Avenue in East New York today. Is he having the same child that I had? The childhood where I got up in the morning, I got on my bike, I took off into the neighborhood. The only limit was to be home for dinner.
That's it. So that brings me to, as a teacher, could you imagine these mass shootings? I can't even comprehend.
No. You know, let me tell you something. I'm doing this TV show. It's a cop thing, and we had a scene where I get choked up. We had a scene where we're in a restaurant. These two guys jump in. One guy's got an automatic weapon. One guy's got a handgun, and they open up on everybody in there. And when I tell you, it was frightening. And these are not even full loads, so it's not even as loud, and not even as smoky, and not even as. And it was still so crazy. And then to imagine being in a church or in a school, there's no place to go, you know. I marched here in New York for the kids, the Parkland kids, and there was a couple of speeches that blew my mind, but one was a girl that was there. She's 15 years old. She told the story of she was with 18 students, the guys running up and down the hallway shooting and going crazy. They run into a room, the whole bunch of them. They get on the floor, and a 15-year-old kid gets up and gets by the door, and he holds the door. He says, don't worry, I won't let him in. And another kid got up, another 15-year-old kid got up and says, I'm with you. And these two kids are going to put their lives on the line. She said, now I got a 15-year-old kid protecting me. This is insane.
I think what's amazing is everything that you have done as a professional is with voice. You're an actor, you're an activist, you're a teacher. What does that mean to you to be able to have freedom of speech and use your voice? What do you do with your platform?
Well, don't you think that's why Facebook is so popular? Because everybody wants their own talk show, their own platform. And so you have it. You're on Facebook. You can reach a whole bunch of people. I don't think of it that way. I just think it's about doing it. What can I do? I want to do something. I don't want to talk about it. I want to do something. That's why I tried to teach, because I wanted to teach. I wanted to see what it was to feel like. So now I can say, hey, you know, I did that. And, you know, now I'm one of the things I'm working on here in the city I'm really excited about is this Police Athletic League acting program.
Oh.
I was working, when I first got back to New York, I moved back to New York in 2011, and right after I taught. And I was looking to volunteer someplace. And I found this place called the All-Stars. It's a terrific program. And they had a program they were just starting with a guy named Brian Hill, who had just gotten there, to a young guy. put up in this program. It's called Youth Development Through Performance. So basically, it's an acting class, but there's life involved and all this other stuff, and you get improv and acting and voice and dance. But you know, the teachers are all volunteers, and they're all. And again, we go back to that good role model thing that I'm worried about. This here, you got another model, and one of the reasons why these are good role models is because they're there every day. Yes. Every day, the kid comes back.
Up.
They show up. That's big. That's really big. So I took it to PAL, and I'm on the board of directors now of the Police Athletic League. And I was a PAL kid, by the way. I became a PAL kid when I was 12. I was on Fulton Street, and the beat cop said to me, he strongly suggested I should give PAL a try.
Is this after you got kicked out of Catholic school?
I was out of Catholic school by that, yeah. And it's not something I'm proud of, by the way, but anyway, so I took it to PAL, and I got a grant, and we started a little program up at the Harlem PAL Center on 114th and or 119th, whatever it is, in Manhattan. And I have to tell you, we started with 15 kids. We ended up with 34 kids when we finished. We started with 15, and the word got out. And so it started to spread. So then we raised some money, and now we have three installations. We have two in Manhattan and one in the Bronx. And we graduated 60 kids in December. We've got over 200 kids in the program now. And, you know, I want to...
These are tough kids. You tell me your stories. These are...
Yeah, every neighborhood in the city. We go and solicit in the schools. And the schools are so, you know, out of money and without any arts. They love to see us because the kids get some arts. They get some art education. This is really important. You know, people. I just don't think people understand how important the arts are. I didn't know when I was a kid and how important they are growing up and how much what a difference it makes in the way you think and everything else. So I'm pushing that. And so this we got another benefit June 28th this year again at John Jay. And you know what the slogan is? The slogan for the program is PAL acting, because when you teach a kid how to act, you teach a kid how to act. But we see tremendous results. And I think about myself, you know, when I went to Hollywood. I got to Hollywood, I was 26. I was a really immature 26. And I developed that 5 years of acting on Taxi. Around good people, around people, of being part of something bigger than yourself, of letting your guard down, of having to speak clearly, of having to listen. You know, all those things we have to do in life, you got to do as an actor. This acting program could make a big difference in the city. First of all, you know, we'll set a benchmark. Commissioner O'Neill has said that he'll set a benchmark at the precinct command level, that the cops in the precinct will have to spend a certain amount of time at the program. Imagine kids meet the cops before they're in trouble. Holy man, what a concept. You know, we're all talking about neighborhood policing. This is a big part. PAL... And this kind of thing is at the nexus of one of the most intractable problems we have in this country, the police and the youth. I mean, we got to get to this. So I'm working on this. What do they want? They want outcomes. They want you to show, how did this benefit? And so that's what we're working on. We're working on being effective, making a difference, not in just sounding great and it has lofty ideals, but really see different kids. And I have seen the difference. I felt the difference because it's happened to me. And as I look out, I haven't seen anything. I'm telling you, I've been around a lot of programs. I've gone to so many benefits and done things. This is the most effective thing I've ever seen, where in a matter of days, you can transform a kid. And I'll give you, you know, one of my favorite stories, if I may, this kid comes to the class. Her name's Sophia. She comes from East New York. She's like 16. She comes to the class, but she don't want to do anything. And by the way, you know, the class can be, you know, we do embarrass ourselves in that class. It's an acting class, so you do stupid games and, you know, all this stupid stuff. All right. So she keeps coming, though. She keeps coming back. So finally, we do this, I love this exercise, where we put these expressionless masks on the kids. And it's so amazing because the minute a kid puts an expressionless mask on, he turns into Laurence Olivier. It's hysterical. And so we got her to put a mask on, and she got into it. She really became a stalwart of the class, and it was wonderful to watch. So we debrief her at the end. We say to her, so what'd you get out of it? And she tells us, well, you know, all the things you want to hear. I saw a side of myself I never saw. I opened myself up. I made friends I would have never made. And remember, these kids are from Brooklyn and the Bronx. That's like, I can't be disrespected. I got to look cool. You can't let my guard down. Well, here we do that, all right? And she said she got into all of that. Then she says, and she slipped it into the conversation like it was, you know, it's raining out. She went, and then, you know what I realized? I think I learned that sometimes you could be a leader by being a follower. Holy mackerel. Talk about critical thinking. In the context of the class, there's always three kids in an acting class that want to do everything, and they have to sit down to make the other, to force the other kids to get up. Because they're letting them kids off the hook by doing it. And she got that. That moment of that kid saying that is, you know, it's just wonderful.
So how often do you cry in the acting class?
I cry a lot in the acting class. You know, I did a crazy thing one day. I was doing current events, and this one article was about having your heart broken. So I said to the kids, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids, hey, anybody had their heart broken in the class? It's one of the greatest discussions you've ever seen, you know? I mean, it's amazing. The kids opened up. That's the kind of stuff we're doing. We're reaching kids in a way that they haven't been reached before. And I'm telling you, it's not that we're the greatest role model. It's a role model. It's another perspective that they don't have. It's incredible. In a matter of days, they're a family. This class is diverse, unbelievable. All of a sudden, my ensemble, you should hear it.
Now you have a new show where you're a cop.
I'm an ex-cop.
Ex-cop. So tell us about this new show you're doing for Netflix.
I'm an ex-con. I'm a disgraced cop. I'm very excited about it. It's called The Good Cop.
Are you a likable character in this?
I am a dastardly likable character. So I have my faults. I have very little scruples. I do things that are hard to explain. So it's a throwback to sort of the days of Columbo. So there's a murder mystery every week, and there's an overlay of an odd couple, father and son. So I played a disgraced ex-cop, ex-con, who was once a celebrated police officer in the city, but now went the wrong way. As a condition of my parole, I have to live with my son in our Bay Ridge home that he grew up in. And he is the good cop. He is a stickler for every regulation. I mean, I'm having a sandwich. I grab a Wendy's napkin. And he says, "Where'd you get that?" I mean, you know, that he's nuts. Everything's an infraction. And they got a guy to play this who is really...
He's earnest.
Oh, he's perfect. I told him he's just annoying enough. And no, he's really wonderful. I can't tell you what a great guy he is. And I wrote him the second week of the show. I said, I want to tell you how much I'm impressed with your work and your work ethic. I'm not presuming to be the greatest judge of it, but I know I'm having a really good time with you. And the guy's name is, ready? Drum roll, Josh Groban, the singer. And so Josh has a scene. He does a lot of this, where he has a scene where he's chasing this killer. They go through the kitchen. The killer runs into a waiter. The stuff goes up in the air. And then there's a knockdown, drag-out fight. So I went down to watch the scene. He did it with the stunt guy. And the stunt guy looks like Josh, and he was really good. And I was standing next to the executive producer. And I went, "Hey, that really looked good, you know? Yeah, I buy that. You buy that? Yeah." So then he says, "Okay, we're going to do it with Josh." Now, Josh comes down. He does the scene. He does it, and I'm not kidding you.
Even better.
He does it better than the stuntman. I mean, holy mackerel.
Where do you go from here? This is your third act.
Good question.
You keep reinventing yourself.
You know, now I'm, whenever I think about this stuff, I think about the acting program, or I think about high school and kids, I just think that's it. You know, you got to do what you can do to try to leave the place a little better than you found it. Saying this like this puts a tremendous amount of responsibility on me. I can't just say this and go home. I got to say this and do something about it. That's what's next for me. This is what I'm supposed to do. You know, I've been struggling with this, too. This is what I've really been struggling with. I've had an interesting life. Lucky, because I had these parents that loved me, and I got every opportunity. And I went to college, and I didn't come out with a huge amount of money. I had a debt, but I didn't have, you know, debilitating debt. I mean, just lucky. So I'm struggling with this. Why? Why am I so lucky? Why am I so blessed? And does this mean the other shoe's going to drop? And so then I realized, Aaron, that no, it's not that the other shoe's going to drop. It's that you got this gift for a reason. You got to do something with it.
Your classroom has changed. Your classroom now is the world. It's the stage in which you perform on, or the television set you're beaming out of. But you're still very much a teacher. So a lot of our listeners will be students. And a lot of our listeners are really caring adults. What do you want their call to action to be? What do you want them to leave this episode doing?
I would encourage people to do some kind of volunteering. I think you have to be involved. Democracy only works if you have an educated electorate. And so, number one, educate yourself. You have to really be discerning about your news source, and you have to put in the effort. I think that those kids in Parkland that are standing up are showing you that there is a way to move people, because they're actually making a difference. You have to be involved. You know, my father, the garbage man, he had a million sayings, my father, you know. But one of his best was, if everybody doesn't buy in, nobody buys in. And so we got to get everybody to buy in. You know, and until we do that, that's the battle. I flash back on being 18. You know, you can't be interesting until you're interested.
Ah, words to live by. Can you give a closing love letter, a shout out to teachers who do feel overworked and underpaid and underappreciated?
What I would say is that, as we all know, as teachers, this is a calling. And sometimes a calling is not easy. And there are moments when it is pure delight, and other moments when it is just despair. And a lot of those times are because of what you have to put up with in order to do your calling. I sympathize, I empathize, I know what you're going through, and I hope there'll come a time when, you know, we wake up to how important what you're doing is and how important public education overall is to our society and to our world.
In honor of their truth, may you follow your calling. That concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier, with production assistance from Clay Amantorp. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please share it with your students, your colleagues, your friends, and family. And if you feel inspired, please leave us a review. It helps the podcast grow, so we continue to have that message of hope and freedom for everyone who listens. Our call to action today is this. May we strive to be good role models. May we do something to get involved. And may we remember, as our guest Tony Danza says, in order to be interesting, you have to be interested. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.